Hello, friends. This is Michael, and we are continuing with our work on the Treatise on White Magic, the section 2 that deals with the rules for magic on the emotional plane, or in relation to the astral emotional plane. We have finished. There are 50 programs, I believe, to be found on Makara right now, and later to be found on the YouTube. And these 50 deal with the introduction and the rules for magic on the mental plane. Okay, so now we're dealing with the astral plane, and we will proceed. Okay, we've done one program. At least, you know, to get started. All right. Now, he said, you know, just reviewing the last little bit where we left off. In this instruction, I seek to give some clear teaching on this plane. For the moment a man can see on the astral plane and can achieve equilibrium and hold steady in the midst of the vibrating forces. Now, remember, this is Rule 7. And we're talking about the seventh sign, which is Libra, the sign of equilibrium. So it certainly can be applied to this particular rule. Let's see, I just collapsed the ribbon there. Okay. Right. Then the moment he can achieve equilibrium and hold steady in the midst of its vibrating forces, that moment he is ready for initiation. And we do remember how closely this seventh sign is actually related to the first initiation. It is ruled by Uranus, the planet with its seventh ray soul prominent at the first initiation, helping to raise the sacral center energy, which it rules, up to the throat center, which is the third ray center, but also has much seventh ray when the first initiation is being taken. So we can see that Libra is important here in terms of the equilibrium and the relationship between the etheric body, now conducting higher energies, and the dense physical body, which no longer operates purely on an instinctual basis, and runs away, so to speak, with the individual. Okay, so now, just working through this as if we were in a study group together, we will proceed. First, he says, let us gather together some of the terms which are used to describe the sphere of divine being wherewith a man has first to identify himself. As a matter of fact, all of these planes are spheres, and very often the vehicles themselves are spheres, unless they are more in the ovoid shape. Apparently there are two types. But anyway, it's a generic term. The sphere of divine being, wherein a man has first to identify himself, penetrate to the center, and always at the center one will find pure being, pierce through its veiled illusion. And the word piercing is very important. It reminds us of the horn of the unicorn. It also reminds us of the technique of light, whereby we put forward that beam of light, as it were, and penetrate and dissipate and destroy the various glamours of the astral plane. So, the sphere of being wherewith a man has first to identify himself, penetrate to the center, pierce through its veiled illusion, and eventually stand poised, untouched, and detached, uninfluenced and free. And when you see a word like poised, it immediately suggests the Libra position, standing at the center and no longer swayed by the various types of attraction and repulsion. uninfluenced and free. Again, there's Uranus with its freedom and its centralization, its identification with the very center of the man, the planet of the greatest freedom, let us say. Okay, so getting this headset in the right position so that I can be heard. So the task then is to pierce through the glamour, and notice here that he calls this glamour, or what is operating on the astral plane, a kind of veiled illusion. So you see the flexibility of the term illusion. The great illusion, in one way, is really the entire universe when compared with absoluteness. And so illusion, or delusion, which is the result of believing and adhering to illusion, exists in relation to the astral plane as well. So these terms are fluid. That's all I want to really point out. Glamour, illusion, and Maya have been used in a general sense and are fluid. The term astral, so often used, is in reality a misnomer. Now, it often means, star-like, but that's not how the astral plane really is, according to DK. HPB was basically right when she used the term in connection with the etheric or vital planes of the physical plane, which have their star-like radiance, the prana and the kind of active heat that is operative there does have that radiance. When contact is made with the etheric world, the first impression given is always of a starry light, of brilliance, and of a brilliance of scintillation. And maybe, you know, some have experienced that kind of contact, even when falling asleep, the waves and bands of color that DK describes, and perhaps that kind of brightness of which he speaks. Gradually, however, the word became identified with kama. That's not karma, it's kama. I'm trying to, get this little picture upright. Kama, or desire, and so was used for the plane of emotional reaction. Now, you know, with all of the mists and veils and clouds and miasmas and steams of stream, or the streams of steam. I've been away from this for a couple of days, so excuse me. All right, it's hardly star-like. But let's see what DK says about this. It is interesting to note this, for it is an instance in itself. It's an instance of the effect of the astral plane upon the human brain, which in its uninformed condition reverses the reality and sees things in an upside down state. And that is so vitally important. I think we have seen this, you know, when dealing with our friends and associates, and maybe also with those who know less about these matters. I actually want to make that quite prominent, if I can. All right, there we go. So there is a, well, let's call it a kind of a astral reversal. The brain reverses the truth. A reversal. The appearance of the astral plane, when first definitely seen, not simply imaginatively seen, but definitely seen by the opened eye of the aspirant, and that can be the third eye or simply the ability to see on that plane, is one of dense fog, confusion, changing forms, interpenetrating and intermingling colors, and is of such a kaleidoscopic appearance that the hopelessness of the enterprise seems overwhelming. So this is the idea here of how very unastral, in the starry radiant sense, is the astral plane. Dense fog. We need a good sun of the soul to dissipate that fog. Confusion, one line is mistaken for another, and the boundaries are not certain. Constant mutability, things blending and merging. So there's no stability. It's a kaleidoscopic appearance, and let's just say a completely unstable view. It is not light or starry or clear. Now, you know, when you read the books of Leadbeater, he seems very much to love the astral plane, and for him, this kind of description is not generally found. Maybe he can stabilize what he sees because he has that kind of experience. Okay, now something has happened here, and I guess I'll hit my stride here just a little bit. When you're away from things, it can happen. It is apparently impenetrable disorder, for it is the meeting ground of forces, and apparently these forces disturb each other and prevent stability. Because the forces in the aspirant's own body are equally in disorder, and because the body affects the astral plane, he blends in with the surrounding chaos to such an extent that it is at first almost impossible for the onlooking soul, let's say in incarnation, the onlooking consciousness, to dissociate its own astral mechanism from the astral mechanism of humanity as a whole, or from the astral mechanism of the world. So we have here an indistinguishability. And anything but clear lines of demarcation. Now, maybe when the fifth ray is applied to this confusion and then the light is brought in, some of this fluid chaos is resolved. But apparently not at first. So, lest we glamorize or in some way exalt the importance of the astral plane, or begin to think of it as a very desirable area of phenomena, it is the greatest area of illusion and misleads. And even our brain is reversing things and turning things upside down. And many of us, I don't know, if people are using substances, let's say they impair the ability of the brain to see clearly, to think clearly, and they suffer the consequences with a loss of reality of perception. So one of the first things then that the aspirant has to learn is to dissociate his own aura. You know, what's yours, what's mine, what belongs to me, what belongs to the environment. Dissociate his own aura in the emotional sense. Whose feeling is it anyway? Is it mine? Is it some wider feeling? from that of his surroundings. And much time is expended in learning to do this. So the whole idea, am I really seeing what is, out there on the astral plane, or is it my own stuff that I am seeing? And you know how often people are involved with projection. They don't know it. And what they see in another is really thrown upon that other by their own condition. And it's very hard, as any psychologist knows, to remove projections. It is for this reason that one of the first qualifications of discipleship is discrimination. So, fifth ray, and also fourth plane. It is the highest of the subplanes of the mental plane. So, but clearly telling one thing apart from another. So there, the Neptunian effect of confusion and blurring, the effect of Neptune on an unprepared form is not necessarily the positive Buddhic and identificatory effect that comes later. It is for this reason that one of the first qualifications of discipleship is discrimination. For it is through the use of the mind as analyzer and separator, and this tells us a lot about the functions of the concrete mind, that the astral body is brought under control. So a mentally focused individual can bring the astral plane under control, or let's just say his own astral body under control. You don't have to be mentally polarized, that's a state that comes later, but at least mental focus can help to do that. One cannot control a field from when one is identified with that field. One has to be somewhat removed. So we work from a higher plane, and we are somewhat removed from the astral plane and can treat it more like an object, treat it objectively. And then, anything that we can treat objectively and stand back from, the philosophical word is, if we can prescind, stand back, or, cut off the identification with it, we are in a position to see it and do something about it. We're in a position to manipulate it, or at least stabilize it, clarify it, and so forth. So let me think so I can see. Let me stand back so I can see. And then I can do something. So that, kind of tells us this chaotic state that we are really confronted with, and we don't know it. We don't know how chaotic it really is. Maybe sometimes one can just sort of feel emotions swirling and realize there just isn't a way to think clearly immediately in such a swirling environment. So one has to remove oneself, prescind, abstract, pratyahara, draw back, and from a more stable position on the analyzing, thinking, deliberative reasoning mental plane to get a grip on what's going on and not be swept by emotion. I mean, a true disciple, coming under at first Mercury and Saturn, two planets much involved with the thought process, is not going to be driven up and down the land, as it is pictorially described, by the emotions. That doesn't mean we don't have deep feelings. and the story that Jesus wept. I mean, there is great depth of heart, and one can weep, but it's not the same as being driven here and there by chaotic desire. Secondly, the astral plane is the plane of illusion, of glamour, and of a distorted presentation of reality. Now, some people just love what they find there and they advertise it and they mislead many, So there are, what's it called? Deluders of souls. When the dweller on the soft line rays takes over, he talks about the second ray deluder of souls instead of the teacher of souls, and third ray manipulator of souls, and first ray destroyer of souls. The illusion, of course, is basically believing in your misinterpreted thoughts, and they are brought down, and great emotion is attached to them, and desire is attached to these misinterpretations. Then it becomes illusion on the astral plane. Oh, so there's some crazy thing going on here that won't allow me to. I'm just hoping. Right. I don't know if I have too much on this computer, it's very likely, but every once in a while I go to save and I cannot. Then it gives me the signal, gives me another chance, and then I can. Okay. So what was I saying? That when our misinterpretations are keenly desired, then we drag illusion down onto the astral plane. Okay, so the reason for all this illusion and glamour and distortion, remember that etherically there is a veil of distortion related to the astral plane, and we're not going to get the chaotic emotionalism off the etheric physical plane unless we deal with that veil of distortion. So the reason for this is that every individual in the world is busy working in astral matter. And the potency of human desire and of world desire produces that constant outpicturing and form building which leads to the most concrete effects of astral matter. So it's a very busy plane with many, many people outpicturing their desires. Then we run into that, and we run into the desire to meet the master and what the master will look like and all that, and we take it for reality, and then we write books about it, and people buy the books and read the books and think it's entirely new, and become falsely elevated by what they read. So it's going to be a fight to disabuse ourselves of those things. Individual desire, national desire, racial desire, the desire of humanity as a whole for relief, all the glamour around what heaven is, plus the instinctual desire of all subhuman lives, in the animal kingdom, let us say, and maybe even in the plant kingdom, causes a constant changing and shifting of the substance of the plane. So it is really an area of profound instability, we might say, right? And we cannot orient ourselves properly. We are at sea, literally at sea, in the astral sea. There is a building of the temporary form, some of rare beauty you know, as sure with when we die and have to pass through that wilderness, the 40 days of wandering in the wilderness, you know, Master Moria tells us pass through swiftly, you know, and maybe in insulated manner so we don't get sidetracked. Some of rare beauty, some of no beauty, and a vitalizing by the astral energy of its creator. So myriad are the forms we will encounter. And quite worthless in many respects. Add to these forms that persistent and steadily growing scenario. You know, by now, it must be huge. And accurate, could we but read with accuracy. That steadily growing scenario we call the Akashic Records, which concern the emotional history of the past. Add the activities of the discarnate lives, which are passing through the astral plane, you know, as it were, wandering in the wilderness and sometimes getting trapped there for longer, far longer than is necessary, either out of or towards incarnation. Quite interesting to think of what it would be like to descend. For me, it's easier to imagine what it's like to ascend from the incarnate life. But in the section on appropriation in esoteric psychology, too, I think there are some hints given about the descent of the intending soul to incarnate. So if you add to all of this form building, the Akashic Record, ever expanding, which deals interestingly with the emotional history of the past, I guess it's how we all react to what happened, and not only purely what happened, how we all react to what has happened, and not only purely what has happened. And add the activities of the discarnate lives, which are passing through the astral plane, either out of or towards incarnation. Add the potent desire, purified and intelligent, of all superhuman lives, and note these superhuman lives do have desire. It's not like we kill out desire. What we do is we kill out desire for the fruits of the phenomenal world. We don't kill out the desire to serve and help and aid and lift. So anyway, the superhuman lives are also active there, including those of the occult planetary hierarchy and perhaps beyond, and not quite, including those of the hierarchy. And the sum total of forces is stupendous. That's really what he wants to get across. That we're just dealing with something, well, extremely difficult to control, to deal with, and it's the master is the master of the lower 18 subplanes, basically. Maybe the lower 21. Of course, the Temple of Solomon is gone by that time. But he's not the master of the higher cosmic etheric worlds, and we human beings who are not yet at that stage, or even at the maybe true initiates or fourth degree, for us, there's no control at all. One just has to be able to stabilize oneself, and one is not going to be able to regulate those phenomena. All play upon, around, and through every human being. Think of it. Upon, around, and through constant astral currents, and according to the caliber of his physical body, you know, because of its very weak and susceptible, and maybe the lower astral will have a an easier orientation, an easier conduit. Maybe the lower astral plane will affect him more easily if the physical body is weak, and the condition of his centers will be his response. You know, the old idea here is that energies are energies, and the effect depends upon the condition of the forms upon which those energies play, and forces as well. We don't always discriminate between the words energy and forces, but generally the energy is more like a great reservoir from which the force descends in a more directed manner to act upon the form. We read of the Shambhala energy, but we also read of the Shambhala force, and it's probably the Shambhala force that involves the impacts, Shambhala impacts, of which there have been relatively so many lately as hierarchy approaches Shambhala and even humanity tries to become sensitive to it, at least humanity, that part of humanity that's on the path. Through this illusory panorama, or in other words, look in every direction and it's illusion, right? Would you say? Oops, sorry. In every direction, there is illusion. The aspirant has to make his way. Sounds blinding, doesn't it? Very confusing. Easily misled, easily led into the swamp by what they call the will-o'-the-wisp, you know, an irrlicht, a light that is full of error and leads you into error. The aspirant has to make his way, finding the clue or thread which will lead him out of the maze. And this is going to be high desire and light from the soul-infused Okay, that's not going to work. Soul-infused mind. And holding fast to each tiny fragment of reality as it presents himself to him, and learning to distinguish truth from glamour, the permanent from the impermanent, and the certainty from the real. So this is the distinguishing which true discrimination gives. And we are no longer confused. Eventually, if we can hold fast to the thread, well, in a way, the Antikarana is the thread. And by the time, you know, we are approaching the second initiation and the Antikarana building is proceeding, and Mercury, that mental planet, is so active, having all the rays, 3, 4, and 5 there, all the mental rays, maybe we can really begin to distinguish between the unreal and the real. You know, lead us from darkness to light, from the unreal to the real. That's the glamour-busting work we do. From death to immortality, and then on to from chaos to beauty, and from the individual to the universal. Ultimately, the individual is not real, though it is actual, and the universal, which we are, is real. So it kind of, you know, if you wake up some night on the other side, you know, look around and see what's there. Maybe you don't look too hard or you'll just wake up, but be the observer. And perhaps observe, but don't put the mind into high gear, or it will perhaps make the scene vanish and you will not be able to continue your observation. So as the old commentary puts it, look, again. I don't know how that happened, but I'm going to have to save, and this time I'm going to call it number 7. That's amazing. Okay, let the disciples seize. Oh, I think we'll just suspend this for a minute. Okay, so let's proceed. When your computer gets too full, watch out. So let the disciple seize hold of the tail of the serpent of wisdom. All these serpents, you know, and they have different reputations. Some are of wisdom. Some are planetary logoi. Some represent deep illusion and deception. But the serpent is one of those figures in occultism which is ubiquitous. It will always be there. And we just have to realize of what nature the serpent. We can't condemn all serpents as evil. That would be a huge mistake. When St. Patrick, he drove the serpents out of the British Isles, something like that, or Ireland, was it? He drove the wise ones, the druids, out. Maybe not the best thing, but then the sixth ray was coming and the seventh ray was giving way. So let the disciple seize hold of the tail of the serpent of wisdom, and having with firmness, you know, what can we say, with stability, grasped it, let him follow it to the deepest center of the hall of wisdom. Now this has to go beyond that which the open sacrifice petals reveal. The hall of wisdom is profoundly deep, you know, so there's something that the open sacrifice petals reveal, but it's not the absolute profundity of the hall of wisdom. Okay, so let him follow it to the deepest center of the hall of wisdom. Let him not be betrayed. Now watch this. Into the trap set for him by the serpent of illusion. We're always going to have to discriminate, right? Always discriminate as we go forward, because we're test after test. But let him shut his eyes to the colorful tracery upon its back. Sounds like Odysseus chaining himself to the mast when the sirens are singing. He wanted to hear their sound, and he railed against his men for not letting him go. But then before he was attached to the mast, he demanded that under no circumstances, no matter what he said, would they release him. So that gives us a hint as to how to pass through this colorful tracery, all this beauty, you know. Let him shut his eyes. Odysseus was brave, you know. But maybe for the rest of us, we're not chained to the psychological mast, we better shut our eyes. Let him shut his eyes to the colorful tracery upon its back, and his ears to the melody of its voice. Let him discern the jewel set in the forehead of the serpent, whose tail he holds. You know, he's working from the bottom up, and in a way he's working from the base of Kundalini up to the point to which it rises, and by its radiance traverse the miry halls of Maya. And that, you know, that's all of the areas of Maya glamour and illusion, all of the areas of Maya glamour and illusion, by comparison to that which the jewel in the lotus, or the various types of jewels, even the monad, the jewel in the monad, and who knows, but that are very central traveling monad, is a jewel in a way. It's called a jewel in the crown. It's kind of a British reference there, but a jewel in the crown of the planetary logos. So instead of elaborating on this, I'm going to just read it. Let the disciple seize hold of the tail of the serpent of wisdom, and having with firmness grasped it, let him follow it into the deepest center of the hall of wisdom. Let him not be betrayed into the trap set for him by the serpent of illusion, but let him shut his eyes to the colorful tracery upon its back, and his ears to the melody of its voice. Let him discern the jewel set in the forehead of the serpent whose tail he holds, and by its radiance traverse the miry halls of Maya. Now, you know, in the opera Parsifal, and probably in the legend about Percival Parsifal, Klingsor, the disgraced knight of the Grail, laid a trap in the Garden of the Flowers, the Garden of the Beauties, you know, such irresistibly beautiful women for these knights. And it was his goal to have them be lured into the garden and fall through their attraction to the beautiful women, the flowers. And this is a kind of an allegory of how there are so many beautiful things that might attract us, and even in apparently justifiably so, to spend time, dalliance, you might say, involved with lower things that are pleasureful, and fail to continue our path or our journey to the very highest things represented by the jewel in the lotus, the jewel as the monad, the jewel in the crown, the jewel beyond, you know. How many facets does the jewel have? Does the universal jewel have? No way to, that's totally beyond us, but so there has to be a certain severity in one's approach. A certain Saturn, which just says no to the reach of Martian desire. And probably, you know, that's not easy, and many people get trapped. They call it the laying of a trap. Well, Klingsor definitely laid a trap, and I suppose the members of the Black Lodge can use that kind of allurement to sidetrack and hamper and weaken a true disciple, a knight of the Grail, as it were. And one has to be wise enough to resist the evident pleasure that would occur through the dalliance in the Garden of the Flowers, or the Garden of Glamour or Illusion, however we want to think of it. One would wake up. There's a wonderful song by Robert Schumann about two youths that started out full of optimism, but one of them got caught by the wave, you know, and it wasn't till years later that he awoke from, he emerged from the wave, and he was tired and old and could no longer go on. So we have a certain amount of energy, and it has to be spent in things that are worthwhile in relation to the divine plan, and in the moment, sometimes it's hard to separate oneself from the present allurement. No glamour, no illusion can long hold the man who has set himself the task of treading the razor-edged path which leads through the wilderness, through the thick-set forest. It's remembering the forest of error in the Fairy Queen. I think it's by an Elizabethan author, Spencer is his name. It's an allegory of the path through the thick-set forest. And here in Finland, we've got a lot of that. through the deep waters of sorrow and distress which we will all experience until we realize that the soul is immortal and all those who are lost are returned, even on a higher turn of the spiral, until they become oneself and one becomes them. Through the thick-set forest, through the deep waters of sorrow and distress, through the valley of sacrifice. See, notice the waters, thick-set, valley, mountains. See, it puts it all in terms of the landscape. And over the mountains of vision to the gate of deliverance. That's marvelous. I love it. The door of initiation. The door of initiation. No glamour can long hold. It reminds us a little bit of being chained to Busiris in the labor of Hercules. Hercules believed in Busiris, and Busiris basically said, you have to stay here with me, otherwise you can't be liberated. And of course, that is the ploy used by many intermediaries who want to be fed by those who believe in them. Master Moria breaks it down into lions, doves, and rats. What a wonderful combination. The lions are the first-rate type, the doves, the second-rate type, who force others to feed them. The rats, or mice, they've chewed many a book without gaining any benefit from it. Master Moria says, please liken people to animals if you want them to wake up, because their human pedigree will not tolerate that likening, and they will uphold their pedigree in repulsion against that likening. He may travel sometimes in the dark, and the illusion of darkness is very real. Well, I would say, seemingly real or actual. I was thinking about those boys in the cave. Here it is, 2018. They've just today been delivered through the door of the gate of deliverance. Out of that cave, 4 kilometers in and under the mountain by almost a kilometer, 600 meters or something of that nature. And they all made it out alive thanks to the skill and the heroism of the Thai, the country Thailand, Thai Navy SEALs, and support from all around the world. It just takes my breath away when I think of it. And I'm sure any one of us could imagine what it was like to spend 9 complete days in the dark before being discovered with no food and no water, no clean water. There was some water around, but And every one of them was brought out. I suppose there's still a question about the health. They seem to be generally healthy. But what a world task, the cooperation involved, the concern, the prayers. How could one help but pray for them and send the angels to guide and help? But without that rough first-rate skill of those Navy SEALs and other divers going through places so small that the oxygen tanks had to be put through the hole first in order for the person to slide in. They couldn't do both. And the rocks, razor sharp. Just takes my breath away to think about the heroism of that rescue, and it was a victory for the forces of light to mobilize world cooperation in such a way. So this is a day in a way of jubilation that, you can wonder, what are they doing in there? 4 kilometers from the entrance in the rainy season, and I'm sure that will be brought to light. A fine day, they chose to go in, and then later, suddenly, unexpected, a thunderstorm and blocked their way out. Well, all kinds of things you encounter on the astral plane. Master Rakotsi, Master R, in his book, The Most Holy Trino Sophia, he is a third ray monad, okay. He seems to recount various initiations he's had on the inner planes. And they are arduous, and they are seemingly dangerous, maybe very dangerous. So initiation was not always what we imagine it to be. In some of the old rites, you had to generate your own light from the Ajna Center, and if you didn't, you wouldn't see all of the crocodiles, literally crocodiles, that lay in wait for you if you couldn't see your way around them. Interesting, though, that the crocodile eats the heart of the one who is returning to incarnation rather than being free at the fourth initiation. So there's a lot of symbolism in it. It's identified with the Makara. So courage is of the utmost importance. And the second ray types have to borrow much from the first ray, as the first ray have to borrow from the second ray. Well, you know, maybe a little diversion. But, you know, I want to kind of talk to you as if we'd be in a class together. And what comes to my mind, and, you know, you'll be maybe using these things in your own classes. And hopefully they will be of use to you, and you'll have your own discussions. You know, you'll have your own discussions. All right. Now, what else? Sometimes he may travel, sometimes in the dark, and the illusion of darkness is very real. I'm sure the dark night of the soul in its various guises is experienced by us, will be experienced by us, and it seems very real. Excuse me. He may travel sometimes in a light so dazzling and bewildering that he can scarcely see the way ahead. He may know what it is to falter on the path, as if, you know, the runner stumbles. It was a movie about a priest who had lost his faith and had given in to temptation. He may know what it is to falter on the path, but always, of course, you know, the inner source will provide the energy if we simply remember to realign with it and to pursue that alignment, and to drop under the fatigue of service and of strife, because the two actually go together. Just try it. You know, you try to serve others, and you will arouse the ire of those who do not want to see them served. Imagine being in a country where the, let's say, rich landowners owned everything, and you try to fight for the rights of the disinherited people, peasants, poorer people. There will be strife. He may be temporarily sidetracked and wander down the bypaths of ambition. Think of it. I'm special. I will rise. I will be important. You know, I. Of self-interest and material enchantment. He tells us that heights of materiality, of luxury, were reached in Atlantis that we cannot conceive at all. But the lapse will be but brief. And let's just say, relatively so, but regrettable. and, you know, emerging sadder, but wiser and more intent. Nothing in heaven or hell, on earth or elsewhere, as there is elsewhere, can prevent the progress of the man who has awakened to the illusion. Now, we really do dispel that illusion at the third degree. All right, here we go again. I have a little problem, don't I, with telling me that I can't save. Nothing in heaven or hell or elsewhere can prevent the progress of the man who has awakened to the illusion, or who has glimpsed the reality beyond the glamour of the astral plane, and who has heard, even if only once, the clarion call of his own soul. The Master DK is inspiring. Some say he has been a poet, you know, and he certainly, there are the sections of his books where he offers clear information, some of the clearest you ever find. And then there are those paragraphs which are clearly inspirational paragraphs meant to lift you, to motivate you, to charge you, to send you in the right direction. And this is one of them. Nothing in heaven or hell, on earth or elsewhere, can prevent the progress of the man who has awakened to the illusion, who has glimpsed the reality beyond the glamour of the astral plane, and who has heard, even if only once, the clarion call of his own soul. It's like the trumpet sounds, you know, now in the misinterpretation, all those dead, rotting bodies or whatever, you know, rise up at the resurrection day and will be judged accordingly. Some going to heaven, some going to hell, etc., etc. The concrete mind can make a real mess of reality. But the trumpet shall sound, and the dead shall be raised incorruptible, as it says, you know, in the Bible and in the great work of art, the Messiah, the trumpet shall sound. And what is that resurrection? It is, you know, rising into the higher planes. And you don't have to be dead for the trumpet to sound. The clarion call of a soul, the clarion call of the higher aspects of our nature, of the spirit, and so forth. The clarion call of the initiator. So, you know, we're being inspired here as we read, and this is the end. Whoop. Let's see what happens here. This is the end of a treatise on white magic video commentary, number two. And today, having skipped a day, and regretfully so, is the 10th of July. And here we have the beginning of a treatise on white magic video commentary, number three. We'll see when I can begin it, hopefully as soon as possible. I've decided, you know, sometimes I'm criticized for reading too fast, and I know I do, and I talk too fast. I have Mercury, you know, right on the midheaven, and it's in Aries, that speed along sign. I've decided, at least until I forget to do so, to talk a little bit slower and think perhaps a little bit more rather than racing into what may be inaccuracies and statements that are less useful to you. So anyway, for the moment, maybe a little slower, and we will continue to put this onto YouTube, and hopefully you'll be able to go there, and then eventually it will be on Makara as well. So lots of love to everybody. Many blessings. Study hard, study hard. We have so much to assimilate in a short time, and to apply what we assimilate practically and occultly, and there's really no difference between practical and occult, really. So with spiritual occultism in our mind, we move forward aligning with the divine plan and trying to work out our little piece of it in the environment in which we're given to work. Okay, see you later, and hope that later is soon.